Our return trip was so delayed by rush hour traffic that I missed my flight. It did not faze Pepe. He called his pilots. They picked me up at his building and drove me to his private jet. It seemed terribly ironic that two pilots and thousands of dollars of jet fuel would fly me all the way to Miami so I could squelch Pepe's project. At first I felt guilty accepting his plane, then exonerated. I figured the Mayan shaman and the geothermal spirits would be amused and grateful. One statement Pepe made haunted me for years. Mark my words, the challenge of the next few decades will be to keep the indigenous people, the Indians, down. Those words took on new relevance as we approached and entered the third millennium. Beginning in 1998, seven countries in South America, over 300 million of the continent's 370 million population, had voted for presidents who campaigned against foreign exploitation. Despite the proclamations of our press and politicians, the votes were not for communism, anarchy, or terrorism. They were for self-determination. Through the democratic electoral process, our neighbors sent us a strong message. They do not seek our altruism. They simply want our corporations to stop abusing them and their lands. Latin Americans are following in the footsteps of Payne, Jefferson, Washington, and all the courageous men, women, and children who stood up to the British Empire in the 1770s. It is a fascinating twist of history that, marching at the forefront of today's revolution against empire, are the indigenous people. While our founding fathers based their new government on Iroquois principles and our Continental Army used Indians as scouts and soldiers, in the end, our nation rewarded them with exclusion and genocide. For many South American countries, they are the vanguard. A new generation of heroes is emerging. Although born of pre-Columbian cultures, these leaders view their constituency as the poor and disenfranchised, regardless of race, heritage, and religion, or whether they live in crowded slums or on remote subsistence farms. Nowhere is this more evident than in Bolivia. As I followed the Bolivian presidential elections in 2005, I wondered what Pepe was feeling. How did he react when an indigenous farmer from the humblest of backgrounds, an Aymara Indian, won with an overwhelming mandate? Evo Morales' victory was the materialization of Pepe's nightmare. Watching TV coverage of the post-election celebrations, I was transported back to the time when I was offered one of the most powerful jobs in that country. The way it happened is illustrative of the corporatocracy's attitudes and actions. Chapter 17. Recruited as President of Bolivia Power. Bolivia is emblematic of a land exploited by empires. Those words, uttered by a teacher at my Peace Corps training camp in Escondido, California in 1968, stuck with me. The teacher had lived in Bolivia. He continually impressed upon us the toll that centuries of oppression had taken. After I completed training while serving as a volunteer in Ecuador, I often thought about Bolivia. I was fascinated by this landlocked country that on a map looks like the hole in a donut comprised of Peru, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil. During my Peace Corps tour, I visited all but one of Bolivia's neighbors, avoiding Paraguay as a personal protest against its ruler, General Alfredo Stroessner, and his policy of sheltering Nazi SS officers. I also studiously skirted Bolivia because young North Americans we referred to as on the gringo trail, who sometimes stayed with me, described it as more brutal toward its Indians than Ecuador. At that time, it seemed impossible that any place could surpass Ecuador in this category. The indigenous people were considered by the country's wealthy elites as subhuman. Like African Americans in the United States a few decades earlier, they lacked civil rights. Rumors abounded about a sport played by rich young men. They would catch an Indian doing something illegal, like picking hacienda corn so his starving family could survive, order him to run, and then shoot him down. Oil company mercenaries in the Amazon carried out similar executions, although they justified them as fighting terrorists, not sport. Yet, despite the oppression in Ecuador, Bolivia was apparently worse. This point was brought home by the fact that Che Guevara, the Argentine physician who decided to fight oppression, selected Bolivia as his battlefront. The ruling class solicited Washington's aid. Che was relegated to a classification worse than subhuman or terrorist. Because he was supported by Cuba, he was categorized as a communist fanatic. Washington sent one of its most skilled jackals to hunt him down. CIA agent Felix Rodriguez captured Che in the jungle near La Higuera, Bolivia, in October 1967. After hours of interrogation, Rodriguez, under pressure from the Bolivians, ordered the Bolivian army to execute Che. After that, the fist of the corporatocracy tightened around Bolivia. The donut squeezed the hole. Before finally traveling to Bolivia as an EHM in the mid-1970s, I did my research. I discovered that repression there far exceeded anything I had expected, that my Peace Corps teacher and those gringo pilgrims had barely scratched the surface. The country had been plagued by violence since the beginnings of recorded history, the victim of one empire or ruthless despot after another. Bolivia's indigenous cultures were conquered by the Incas in the 13th century. Spanish conquistadors arrived in the 1530s, subjugated the Incas, slaughtering thousands in cold blood, and ruled with an iron fist until 1825. In a series of wars throughout the 1879-1935 period, Bolivia lost its Pacific coast to Chile, its oil-rich Chaco region to Paraguay, and its rubber-growing jungles to Brazil. During the 1950s, a reformist government under Victor Paz Estenssoro initiated programs to improve conditions for the Indian majority and nationalized the oppressive tin mines. The international business community was outraged. The Estenssoro administration was overthrown by a military junta in 1964. Not surprisingly, the CIA was implicated. Coups and counter-coups plagued the nation into the 70s. Even the geography is oppressive. The country is divided by two parallel and exceedingly rugged Andean mountain ranges into three distinct regions. The arid, inhospitable high-altitude plateau, known as the Altiplano, semi-tropical valleys in the west, and lowlands and vast rainforests in the east. The majority of Bolivia's 9 million inhabitants are Indians, who traditionally coax a living from subsistence farms clinging to windswept Andean slopes. Reflecting this ethnic diversity, Bolivia has three official languages: Quechua, Aymara, and Spanish. Although endowed with abundant natural resources, silver, tin, zinc, oil, hydroelectric power, and the second largest natural gas reserves in South America after Venezuela, Bolivia is one of the hemisphere's poorest countries. It was also one of the first to implement the IMF's package of structural adjustment programs, SAPs. I have to take some of the responsibility for that. By the time I arrived in Bolivia in the middle of the 1970s, fear, inspired by Che's legacy, had convinced a coalition formed between the economic elite and the military to brutalize the country's indigenous community. My job was to explore ways we EHMs might induce that coalition to integrate more extensively with the corporatocracy. During meetings with a broad spectrum of Bolivians, I formulated ideas that were similar to those that later gelled into the SAPs accepted by many countries in the 1980s and 1990s. Like Indonesia Suharto, Bolivia's rulers were predisposed to adopting programs that sold their country's resources to foreigners. They had a long history of yielding to and prospering from foreign mining companies. They had incurred excessive debts, and, feeling vulnerable to neighboring countries, their traditional enemies, as well as to their own indigenous populations, they desired to secure Washington's promises of protection and grow rich in the process. They would follow Suharto's example by investing their fortunes in the United States and Europe, thus insulating themselves against future economic crises in Bolivia. At those initial meetings in the 1970s, I concluded that Bolivia was ripe for privatization. La Paz's businessmen and politicians were eager to expand the model initiated by the mining companies. Although this amounted to a sellout of their nation's sovereignty, it relieved them from the burden of raising funds through taxation, capital markets, and their own bank accounts to develop water, sewage and electrical facilities, transportation and communications networks, and even educational and penal systems. With my help, they also understood that they would receive lucrative subcontracting jobs, and their sons and daughters would be rewarded with all-expense-paid educations in the States, along with internships at our most prestigious engineering and construction companies. They enthusiastically approved tax incentives for foreign investors and agreed to drop trade barriers against U.S. imports while accepting ones we imposed on Bolivian products. In essence, Bolivia's economic elite military coalition seemed ready to buy into what constituted a new form of colonialism, so long as it was couched in IMF language such as good governance, sound economics, and structural adjustments. After the government passed legislation to permit joint ventures, attract foreign capital, and remove restrictions on currency conversions, it did not take long to privatize Bolivia's five largest state-held companies. Furthermore, the government announced plans in 1990 to sell as many as 150 state-owned companies to foreign investors. And, in an interesting turn of fate, symbolic of the revolving door that propels so many U.S. government decision-makers into lucrative corporate positions, I was offered the presidency of Bolivia's most powerful utility company. In 1990, Leucadia National Corporation, a U.S. company, contacted me and asked if I would be interested in becoming president of their wholly owned subsidiary, Bolivia Power Company, Compañía Boliviana de Energía Eléctrica, COBE in Spanish. Leucadia had earned a reputation for buying troubled companies and turning them into profit centers. Leucadia would become famous in 2004. When it sought antitrust clearance to buy more than 50% of the stock in MCI Incorporated, the nation's number two long-distance carrier. Corporate representatives informed me that I appeared uniquely qualified to run COBE. In addition to the fact that I had helped structure Bolivia's SAPs, I also, one, was CEO of my own successful independent power company in the United States, a company I had created after leaving the EHM ranks that benefited greatly from favors owed me for my EHM work. 2. Spoke Spanish and was familiar with Latin American cultures. And 3. As a former EHM, was in an ideal position to secure World Bank and Inter-American Development Bank loans needed to expand COBE's system. Following interviews on the East Coast, Leucadia flew my wife Winifred, 7-year-old daughter Jessica, and me to the Salt Lake City mansion where the company's CEO, Ian Cumming, and his wife spent much of their time. After introductory meetings with several executives, we joined the Cummings in their formal dining room for a gourmet 5-course meal served up by the family's chef and staff. Ian and I then retired to his office for a private conversation. At one point, an aide interrupted us and apologetically explained that he had received a fax from La Paz, that the Spanish translator had left for a doctor's appointment, and he hoped I might be able to help. As I read the message aloud in English, I could not help suspecting that my language abilities were being tested. Apparently, I passed that and other tests. Soon after the Salt Lake City visit, Leucadia arranged for the three of us to travel to Bolivia. Chapter 18. Maximizing Profits in La Paz. We landed at El Alto, one of the highest commercial airports in the world, located on a plateau at nearly 13,000 feet above sea level. Exiting customs, we were met by COBE's about to retire president and his wife. They and the rest of the company's top executives treated us like royalty during our stay. They escorted us to colorful local markets, museums, colonial churches, the exclusive Americanized school Jessica would attend, the elite country club that was eager to welcome us as members, and scenic natural points of interest in the mountains surrounding La Paz, including the bizarrely eroded sandstone formations at the Valley of the Moon. They guided us through power plants and substations, and along proposed transmission line rights of way. One cold, rainy afternoon, a company executive announced that he would show us the heart and soul of our operation. I expected a state-of-the-art engineering marvel. Instead, his chauffeur drove us through the freezing drizzle to a commercial bank in the center of La Paz. A ragged line of Indians stretched down the side of the bank building and around the block. They huddled together against the soaking rain, many holding open newspapers above their heads. They were dressed in traditional clothes, woolen pants, skirts, and ponchos. I lowered the car window a crack and was greeted by a blast of cold air and the smell of wet wool and unwashed bodies. Like remnants of the days when conquistadors had lined them up to work the tin mines, they were silent, simply standing there, staring and occasionally taking a step forward toward the massive doors of the bank where a cluster of armed guards watched over them. Dozens of ragged children were scattered along the line. Many of the women carried babies wrapped in shawls that hung dripping water from their shoulders. "They've come to pay their electric bills," the executive explained. "How barbaric," Winifred muttered. "On the contrary," the executive corrected. "These are the lucky ones. Unlike their rural kin, they're privileged, connected to the grid. They've got electricity." As we drove back toward the office, the executive turned from his seat next to the chauffeur and explained that Colbert sent bags of money to the States through the U.S. Embassy on a regular basis, money the Aymara and Quechua had stood in line to deliver. "This company's a cash cow for Leucadia," he added gleefully. I would later learn that although their electric usage might be limited to a single light bulb, once a month they made a pilgrimage to the bank. Lacking checking accounts or credit cards, they stood patiently in line and paid in cash. That night, back in the seclusion of our hotel room, Winifred asked why the embassy should serve as a courier service for a private corporation. I had no answer, except for the obvious: that U.S. diplomatic missions around the world exist primarily to benefit the corporatocracy. We also wondered why the executive had gone out of his way to show us that line. "He seemed so proud of it," Winifred said. "What a warped sense of finance." The next morning we were briefed on the Zongo River project. It sounded to me like the true heart and soul of Kobe. Famous among Latin American power industry executives, it consists of a series of hydroelectric sites that begin near the top of the Andes and descend down a deep gorge into a tropical valley, a model of efficiency and good environmental stewardship. Several engineers assured us that seeing it firsthand was well worth the grueling trip. One shook his head sadly. "It'll never happen again," he moaned. "We all love Zongo because it's a beautiful example of how things can be done. But no modern lender, least of all the World Bank, invests money in such small, exquisitely engineered projects. If they had it to do over again, they'd insist we build a huge dam and flood the entire valley." Kobe's president and his wife offered to take us to the Zongo River. They picked us up at our hotel before dawn one morning in their four-wheel drive station wagon. We drove out of the city and headed up to the Altiplano. A thin blanket of snow covered this barren plateau that resembles an arid version of the Arctic tundra. Suddenly, morning arrived and we witnessed a spectacular sunrise along the massive Cordillera Real. Nicknamed the Himalayas of the Americas, this Andean range includes 22 ice-clad peaks that are 19,000 feet or higher. Several hours later, as we crossed a mountain pass at about 17,000 feet, Jessica had the opportunity to see her first glacier. Alpacas roamed in the pasture separating us from the mammoth ice sheet. We pulled to a stop when Jessica raced across the road to get a closer look, her lips blackened from lack of oxygen. She sank to her knees and vomited violently. Winifred and I hustled her back into the station wagon, and we hurried down to lower altitudes, arriving in mid-afternoon at the first of the hydroelectric sites. A small dam across the glacier melt Zongo River created a retaining pond. From there, the water flowed along canals cut deep into the mountainside, through tunnels, into a metal penstock, and eventually, to a powerhouse where electricity was produced. This process was repeated several times, a system that was ingeniously designed to maximize the energy-producing potential of the river while maintaining the integrity of the natural landscape. As we wound through the gorge, surrounded on all sides by perpendicular cliffs, a fully recovered Jessica made a comment that verbalized my sentiments. "I'm glad they didn't build a big dam and flood this whole valley," she said. "It's so lovely." Eventually, we pulled up to a quaint cottage we were told would be our private retreat if I became president. After settling in, Winifred, Jessica, and I hiked to a nearby waterfall. At 8,000 feet, we felt positively energized after the thin air of La Paz and the mountain pass. We scaled a cliff next to the waterfall. Through the lush foliage, we watched the sun setting behind the mountains across the narrow valley. Then we climbed down and joined our hosts back at the cottage. The caretaker served baked lasagna that tasted as though it might have arrived by courier from Rome. That evening, as Jessica slept, we four adults chatted over cocktails. It was obvious that Cobé's president and his wife had enjoyed their Bolivian tour. It was also apparent that they were now eager for me to assume his position so they could return home. They repeated selling points we had heard before. We would live in a mansion, travel through the streets of La Paz in our own chauffeur-driven car, be protected by armed guards, be pampered by private chefs, maids, and gardeners, and enjoy a deep-pocket expense account for entertaining Bolivia's aristocracy. They pointed out that I would be the second most powerful person in Bolivia, after the country's president. Whenever there was a coup, I would be the most powerful since I would control the flow of electricity to both the presidential palace and the military bases. The CIA would look to me to support their favored party. As we lay in bed, Winifred praised the hydroelectric project. "I've never seen anything to compare," she said, adding, "I wonder if you could use it as the starting point for a sort of utility revolution in Latin America. Get rid of that horrid line those Indians have to stand in to pay their bills. Make electricity available at low prices to rural communities. Develop more projects like the one we saw today. Instead of using World Bank loans to build big power plants and commit the company to environmental stewardship." I listened carefully to what she said. The next day, as we drove back to La Paz, and during the remainder of our stay, I mulled over this idea. On several occasions, I discussed it with Cobé's executives and engineers. Many of them came from Argentina, Chile, and Paraguay, countries with long histories of military dictatorships that served at the pleasure of the corporatocracy. I should not have been surprised by their skepticism. Their comments echoed those of a Peruvian engineer who had worked at Cobé for more than a decade. "Leucadia expected sacks of dough," he observed flatly. The more I thought about this, the angrier I grew. Latin America had become a symbol of U.S. domination. Guatemala under Arbenz, Brazil under Goulart, Bolivia under Estensoro, Chile under Allende, Ecuador under Rodos, Panama under Torrijos, and every other country in the hemisphere that was blessed with resources that our corporations coveted, and that had enjoyed leaders who were determined to use national resources for the benefit of their own people, had gone the same route. Every one of them had seen those leaders thrown out in coups or assassinated and replaced by governments that were puppets of Washington. I had played their game for 10 years as an EHM. Another decade had passed since I had left those ranks, yet I was still haunted by guilt and anger. I had vacillated, detoured away from the principles I had been raised to respect in my eagerness to serve the corporatocracy and gratify my own appetites. My personal prostitution infuriated me, as did the suspicion that any efforts on my part now to change a company such as Cobé would likely be thwarted. Nevertheless, I made a commitment to try. When we returned to the United States, I called the Leucadia executive in charge of recruiting me. I informed him that I would consider accepting the job only if they allowed me to turn Cobé into a model for social and environmental responsibility. I explained that I was deeply impressed by the Zongo River hydroelectric project and that the company was uniquely positioned to be an agent of change, given that it had the opportunity to provide electricity to some of the poorest populations in the hemisphere. There was a long pause. He informed me that he would check with Ian Cumming. However, he said, don't expect much. Our executives answer to our stockholders. A president of Kobe will be expected to maximize profits. Another pause. Do you want to reconsider? His words strengthened my resolve. Absolutely not. I never heard from them again.